there's a difference between using genetics to treat illnesses versus using genetics to try to create a hybrid creature. So to take a human person and somehow cross them genetically with something that's able to live longer or something, you know.
Welcome to Tulsa Time with Bishop Kondrila. My name is Derek Lissy, and I am your host. Bishop, how are you doing this week?
I'm well.
Great.
Well.
That's awesome.
We gave up the secret in the last episode. Sometimes it's the same week.
That's right. I always get a chuckle out of you, whether you realize it or not, every time we do this. And if we film two in a row and you say that, you always laugh. Which is always great. There's always a grin on your face. But you got a couple of events coming up. You got the Clergy Education Days coming up on March 18th. And then there's Tenebrae service going on March 24th. I know, Father John Grant gave us some information on that. It's going to be promoted on the DOS and social media accounts and things like that. And it'll be a lot of people like to attend Tenebrae. For those who haven't attended, what is Tenebrae? What's your experience been with Tenebrae?
Well, we do it in a, I suppose I could call it an authentic way. Tenebrae is a beautiful service of prayer, psalms, and lights. So candle lights.
Yep.
And what Tenebrae is depicting is the dying of the light as Christ goes through his passion, through his death, into the tomb. The light has died. And when he died, he then descended to the underworld to set free those who had been there because there was no way to heaven prior to his death. And that's called the harrowing of hell in literature. And that harrowing of hell is depicted at our Tenebrae service by loud stamping of feet and banging of books on the back of pews. And it's kind of terrifying almost. I mean, we're in the darkened cathedral, and suddenly there's this cacophony of loud and rough noises. And it really does make you feel the sense of the weight of what is happening. So I highly recommend it to people. We can fit 700 people or something like that in the cathedral. So let's fill it up. If you've never been to Tenebrae anywhere, come to the cathedral. When is that? It's on the
March 24th.
Right. In the evening, right?
Yep.
And
Sunday evening.
Yeah. So come on out.
Yeah. And that week, and I know a lot of folks like to attend Chrism Mass on March 26th when all the oils are blessed. I didn't realize this. This was something that I learned just as we were talking about this, but it's the day of prayer for priests.
Yeah.
And so explain that.
For me, the most tense moment of the Chrism Mass is when the people carrying the jars of oil reach the stairs of the sanctuary. And I'm always terrified that somebody's going to drop one of those huge jars of oil and it's just going to be.
Let's just hope that those people don't listen to this.
Yeah,
because they're going to be sweating it out.
Yeah. But right. So the
day of prayer. Yeah.
Yeah. The priest day of prayer. So there's two things here that are connected: the clergy education days and the priest day of prayer. One of the ways that we, as a group of priests, and so that's something for people to think about. That they may not otherwise think about. Consider, for example, the sisters who live in their convent. Well, it makes sense to people that those sisters who live together in their convent need to have a really close relationship with one another as they work together through life. But they may not think that about their priests. The idea of the priests having a self-understanding of being part of a fraternity. Now, maybe because fraternity has a mixed reaction for people, because fraternities on college campuses sometimes are a little outrageous. And ever since the movie Animal House, we have.
And who's to say that the priests couldn't be?
That's right. But definitely we as priests, the bishop and the priest together, do have and want to continue to grow in and inculcate a sense of ourselves as a fraternity, a group of brothers who live and work together in one particular place all of our lives. So you have your pastor successively in your parish, and you tend to think of the priest as, quote, your pastor. I hear from people all the time that they're often moved when they see at something like a chrism mass or an ordination, a big number of priests gathered in one place together.
Yep.
And it reminds them, oh yeah, we've got all, there's priests all over the diocese. There is that. And it's important for us as priests, for our life and for our support of each other, to develop that sense of relationship among ourselves as a group of men dedicated to this ministry. And so one of the ways we do that is through meeting together several times a year at these scheduled events. We have two clergy education days a year, where we also have our permanent deacons invited to those. And a clergy education day is just what it sounds like. We bring in a speaker who's going to address us on some topic that is pertinent to our life and ministry. This particular one is on flock note, of all things. Many of our parishes.
The whole thing is on flock note, the clergy days?
Yeah. Oh, the speaker is the guy that developed flock note. Many of our parishes use flock note as a platform through which they can communicate to all their parishioners.
Yep.
And so the parishioners just download an app of some kind and indicate how they want to be communicated with by the parish. And then the parish can send out one message, and it goes to all these people in all these different ways, and it's amazing. So we're going to be talking about flock note, but under the rubric of communication and leadership. Mm-hmm. So we don't send out flock notes just for the fun of it. We're trying to do something with that. Communication is an important thing. So we want to talk about that. And then the day of prayer for priests, this is our Lenten day of prayer. We also have an Advent day of prayer. So in those two major seasons of the year, we have one day where we spend about half of a day. The priests come together with a presenter. And basically, it's like a mini retreat. We have a couple of preached talks, and then a little time in between them for reflection and prayer. There's opportunity for confession. Another thing that people may not consider, you know, if your priest is always hearing confessions, but he also needs to go to confession, and it can be difficult for a priest to arrange, who do I go to for confession? Even more so for bishops. But there's an opportunity for confession. And then on that particular day, there's also, after the day of prayer, is the Chrism Mass itself. Everyone's invited to the Chrism Mass. That's the Mass where we bless the oils that are sent back out into the parishes for the coming year to be used for the sacraments. And then it's the Mass where the priests renew their promises that they made when they were ordained. So powerful liturgy, wonderful events, really upbuilding for the priests. We have a dinner after the Chrism Mass together. And then, you know, it's Holy Week, so guys have to fly back to their parishes. And so, you know, I'm always thinking about those men, especially on that evening, who have to leave that dinner promptly because they've got to drive 2 or 3 hours to get back to Durant or Ida Bell or wherever they're going back to. So.
Absolutely. And I would agree with a lot of those sentiments. I think that, yeah, you hear that from people all the time, but it's moving to see priests together. Mm-hmm. Just because you see the power of one priest on one altar every Sunday. And just when you see all of them in the room and there's this recognition of, oh my goodness, this mm-hmm. miracle is going on all over this mm-hmm. diocese. It's powerful.
Well, and it's easy for priests to lose sight of the fraternity because they're busy with their particular parish.
Totally.
And so one of the things that we try to become sensitive to as a group of priests is how do we maintain an awareness of how everybody else is doing? If I'm busy in my parish, how do I, even though I'm busy in my parish with all the little details and the wars and the anxieties of my own particular place, how do I maintain an awareness of how my brother is doing somewhere else who may be undergoing some kind of trial, you know, personal or having to do with things in the parish or whatever? How do I maintain a prayerful spirit about him? Do I find some kind of a reminder system for myself so I can remember to call and see how he's doing and reach out to him and so mm-hmm. forth?
Speaking of groups of priests, groups of bishops, I know that you were recently at a major event by the National Catholic Bioethics Center,
yeah.
NCBC. I know you're big on those acronyms. But at the NCBC, yeah. the bishops were there for a number of presentations. Who was all there? What was going on at that conference? Had you been before?
Yeah, this is, it's kind of funny too, in a way. The first one I attended would have been 1987, about when I was a seminarian and served Mass at the conference.
Oh, I see.
Because
I was going to say, can priests and seminarians actually attend?
No.
Yeah, exactly.
But it always happens in Dallas. And so they always have the seminarians from the local seminary where I went to seminary come to serve the Mass. So I've known about it since 1987, but I've only been going since I've been a bishop. And this, you know, there's a similarity between this conference and what we were just talking about, because as much as there's a fraternity of priests who need to maintain a connection as a fraternity, mm-hmm. there's also a fraternity of bishops throughout the country, throughout the world really, but particularly throughout the country, who also need to maintain some kind of a connection. One of the ways we do that is a way similar to how priests do it. There's a style of priest support group called Jesu Caritas, love of Jesus. How does that translate? Jesus love. Mm-hmm. And in this type of support group, a number of priests voluntarily form a group. They meet together once a month, typically. Spend an afternoon sitting in a circle, just going around the circle. Each person is able to speak about whatever's going on.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing? What's going on in your life and ministry? What's coming to you from your prayer? We share those kinds of things with one another. We listen and support one another. Typically, then there's a meal or we go out to eat or something. Again, there may be opportunity for confession. And so I was delighted when I became a bishop to discover that there is also some bishop Jesu Caritas groups. So I immediately joined one. I think there's about 14 or so guys in the group that I'm in. We can't meet once a month. So typically we meet three times or four times a year at meetings we're already scheduled to be at.
Sure. That's interesting you have 14. I mean, you know, as somebody who's been involved in small groups in ministry.
Yeah.
You know, you always talk about that sweet spot, you know, and yeah. we always talk about eight or, you know, or somewhere in there.
And 14, you know, 14. It only works because we're usually not all there.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
So you almost need a roster of 14. So when the guys That's are out, right. you actually have a group to actually have a meeting.
That's Got right. it. Because, there's the two main meetings, the November meeting and the summer meeting. And then every other year, there's a meeting of the Catholic Extension Society mission bishops. So that's about 50 of the bishops throughout the country. Many of the men who are in my Jesu Caritas group are also bishops of mission dioceses. And then every other year, there's this NCBC meeting that is offered, workshop. And a lot of us go to that. And so we're able to meet alongside of that as well. But the meetings that bishops have, the committee meetings and the plenary meetings and these side meetings, they're important for their topics and their work.
Sure.
But they're also important just to be able to get together with the rest of the guys. So every bishop, unless he has an auxiliary or something, he's the only bishop in his diocese. And so whereas the priests have each other, that fraternity, the bishop doesn't have other bishops right here in his diocese. So building that fraternity can take a little more effort.
Yeah, know? I think I can relate to that too, like going to national conferences for work and things like that. You know, just it's great to get together with other people who are, you know, sort of saddled with some or like things. You know, you've talked about bishops you've met before whose dioceses have literally been blown up. You know, we're dealing with very different circumstances than what you're dealing with, especially here in Tulsa, middle of America, middle of the map.
Yeah.
You know, as far as, you know, dioceses, you know, parishes or churches getting blown up or something like that. We're obviously, you know, praise be God, we are not, you know, in that situation, but just good to get together just to share thoughts, best practices. And like you said, create fraternity amongst men who are, you know, tasked with this role.
Yeah, this particular workshop, again, it's put on by the National Catholic Bioethics Center. So anyone can look that up, ncbc.org. And I recommend it to people to look up because bioethics is something that I have always had an interest in, but not everybody does. But typically people do have an interest in the hot button questions that bioethics ultimately always ends up dealing with. And on the website, one can find archived publications, essays, and writings from the NCBC on all kinds of questions. There is a bi-weekly or monthly, what's called the Ethics and Medics letter that comes out, and it has several articles on various bioethical topics. But bioethics, the field of bioethics, it's just what the word says. Ethical thinking, how do we determine what is the right, true, and good thing to do regarding biological science, things that we can do scientifically through our biology. Typically, it has to do with medical treatments of one kind or another or things that impinge on medicine. But it might go afield of that. For example, what are ethical and right, true, and good ways to carry out experimentation, for example?
Bishop, kind of a curious question. Where did your interest, I've talked to you about bioethics stuff in passing over the last 7 years. When did you kind of get hooked? Because I've always known you're interested and you have a curious mind about some of these things. When did that start? Was that seminary? Was it before that? You know, was it, you know, something like Bill Nye, the Science Guy as a kid? You know, like what was, you know what I'm saying? Like when was it that you kind of piqued your interest on all this stuff?
Yeah, I think that I must always have had a curiosity about the natural world, about scientific things in the natural world. Not enough to study science, not enough to be good at math.
That's right.
I love to read about physics. I don't want to physics.
That's right.
So I've always had that, but
it's funny.
In seminary is where I would have come across topics you know, that were controverted. And discovering that there is a logical way to think about these things and to be able to arrive at sound conclusions about difficult topics, I think that's what was appealing to me. Just the logic of theology generally, and now theology related to things that are scientific. I think that's where that comes from. This particular conference was the 29th one they've put on. So since it's every other year, it's 50 years that they've been doing this.
Wow.
The title of this one was called Bringing the Life of Christ to the Dying, facing challenges in end-of-life care. So a lot of the topics and the speakers and the talks were related around those kinds of issues. We had bishops there from Mexico, from South America, from Canada, from all over the United States. There were about maybe 50 or 60 bishops that came to this one. So not everybody comes. Not everybody's able to.
I feel like that's
come.
A healthy number, though. That's a really good number. When I went on the NCBC website, when you had told me you were attending it, and I just started clicking around and, oh, maybe I'll read a little bit of this little, I thought maybe I'd get a little taste of all the different topics. That was impossible. Because when you go to their website and you start looking at all their resources and their articles, it's amazing how much information they do have. And so if there's a hot issue or something that you're trying to learn about, or you have a question, you know, there's a lot of resources there, but it's interesting that bringing the life of Christ to the dying was the theme, because I think we've been talking about death and sort of what happens at Catholic funerals and things like that. Our conversations on the podcast here and there kind of in around. So who were some of the speakers, or what were some of the interesting things that you heard or learned while you were there?
Yeah, we had talks on a lot of different topics. I've got some of them written out here. We listened to a woman who is the Mother Superior of the Hawthorne Dominicans. This particular religious community, they run houses for the dying.
Okay.
So sort of similar to our Porticelli house. Father Sheenan Bouquet, he's the president of Human Life International. And his was a very interesting talk and topic on how do we accompany and take care of older priests who are at the end of their life, who may be dying? And so that's something that's easy for people to lose sight of. We have the annual collection for the retired priests, for example. But these days, a man who retires at 70, who maybe is no longer actively running a parish, I mean, priests are never retired from being priests. You're a priest forever. But the active administration of a parish, a priest can retire from that at 70, and then he's typically living in the area and helping out with lots of different ways. But he might live to his 90s. And so how do we accompany him? How's he maintaining community and connection with people? And then when he is in the process of dying, is he doing that alone? We certainly don't want that. We certainly want to have ways to surround him with people who love and support him. And so that was an interesting topic. We had a woman named Marguerite Duane. She's the executive director of an organization called Facts About Fertility. And I think maybe it's spelled F-A-C-T-S. I've got it written F-A-X.
Yeah.
But Facts About Fertility. So basically has developed an educational model that looks to teach fertility awareness-based methods. So that may be a term of art that people have not heard. Fertility awareness-based methods. So methods of understanding a woman's body and the fertility that a couple share, a husband and a wife share, that are based in their fertility markers. What are the biological markers in the human body that indicate to a person that they're fertile or not fertile, able to conceive a child at this moment or not able to conceive a child at this moment, that their body is healthy, that they're not having any kinds of problems or signs of disease or
illness. This would flow with our NFP work and some of the stuff that Megan Allen's doing for the diocese.
Right. And our Marian Medical Clinic.
And the Marian Medical
Clinic. So this is exactly what they're doing there. But then to bring this to even a wider audience, so high school girls to college age men and women, so that, you know, it is an antidote in a way to the pornographied culture that we live in that wants to think of the human body as a commodity. But instead of that, this is a way of diving deeper under the skin, so to speak, to see the amazing wonder that God has built into the human body, what it's capable of as a way of growing in respect and understanding of the dignity of the person. We had a guy, this is the kind of topic that would be typical of NCBC, but that many people would find boring or something. But it had to do with insurance plans, right? So we had a presenter who was trying to help us understand the complex ways that people can make sure that the insurance plan that they have at work, for example, doesn't also cover things that the church would say are immoral.
Mm-hmm.
And so particularly if you're a business owner, you're responsible to provide some kind of insurance plan for your employees. How do you make sure that the insurance plan you're providing them doesn't also, for example, cover contraceptives or transgender surgeries or, you know, any number of things, euthanasia, et cetera?
Yeah, I think unfortunately, topics like that, from my observation, topics like that, until it's really on your plate that you got to deal with it, it's your company, your insurance, your situation, you kind of tend to ignore it. Now, there's a natural sort of ignorance of it because you've got all this other stuff going on in your life.
Right.
And you've got all these other issues. But in my mind, it's good to know that the bishops are discussing this and that there's an entity like NCBC who's saying, this is coming down the pike. We need to start thinking about this.
But in part because we also provide insurance plans.
Right.
The dioceses do. And so, you know, we've worked hard to make sure that our insurance plans, you know, one of the things that hit the news some few years ago was the Little Sisters of the Poor being sued by the Obama administration, requiring that they cover contraceptives in their insurance plan. They ultimately won that lawsuit, but it's that kind of thing. The culture around us often is trying to force things onto Catholic employers that are contrary to our Catholic faith as a way of either winning some culture, you know, battle in the culture war, or as a way of trying to create larger monopolies on things that require everyone to conform to one particular thing. So that was one of the topics too. A topic that I also was very interested in was a topic on what is called the Uniform Determination of Death Act. So you again, you said I like acronyms.
The UDDA or something?
UDDA, the Uniform Determination of Death Act. And
it's funny.
It's a topic that gets into a controversial area of bioethics that wants to understand, is death something that is subjective or something that is objective? So, for example, if death is subjective, it means that your opinion about this person being dead or not and my opinion about this person being dead or not might differ.
That's right.
But how can human nature have a different, how can there be a different way of understanding whether a human person is dead or not? Death should be objective. We should be able to objectively measure if a person is dead or not. Where this particularly becomes important is in the whole field of organ transplantation, because we would, the church would hold that it is unethical, that it is immoral to remove organs from a living person.
Right. Sounds painful at the outset.
It's illegal, right?
Yeah.
To remove organs from a living person. The person who donates organs must be dead to donate the organs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so therefore it's important to know when are they dead? And there's a pressure that builds against it. It would seem simple in a way. You know, the next day after they quit breathing, we know they're dead. Well, but the next day after they quit breathing and we know they're dead, the organs are also no longer viable to be transplanted. So the pressure that builds in the opposite direction is that the sooner we can remove healthy organs from a person, well, the sooner we can remove organs from a person who has died before those organs become non-viable for transplantation, mm-hmm. the better. So that puts a kind of pressure on, we need to remove these organs as quickly as possible. So we need the most fluid determination of death in a way, you know? So the UDDA comes from an international organization that's an international organization that tries to understand what is for all medical research and medical hospitals and so forth the world over, what is our understanding of when a person is dead, when they're declared dead. And so, you know, one way of doing that is through the cardiopulmonary, when the heart has irreversibly quit beating. So it has quit beating and it will never start again. It's done. And the person has quit breathing, therefore there's no oxygen going to the brain, therefore the brain is done. But in the age of heart-lung machines, when a person might be in the hospital and the process of their illness causes them to be put on a ventilator machine and a heart-lung machine, so the machine is pumping blood through the body. The machine is also oxygenating the blood. How do you determine when the heart?
Yeah.
Or that, so, and so what developed was a way of determining death through whole brain death, because it's also true that when the whole brain is dead, then the person is dead. A person's brain is not the kind of tissue that repairs itself. When it dies, it's dead. It doesn't come back. And so within that field, the attempts to play with the language about what death means, or the necessity and the difficult necessity, just practically speaking, difficult, mm-hmm. to use a various list of tests at the bedside that can determine whether the brain has died or not, to use those tests properly and consistently, because the tests themselves are sort of subject to art, the competence of the person at the bedside. So we need to have the proper list, for one thing, of what the tests are, and then we need to have a way to make sure that they're being carried out properly. So those are all aspects of that conversation, but it's one that the NCBC is constantly paying attention to, is urging such international and national organizations to adopt a standard of death that is not subjective, that is objective, and that can be objectively demonstrated at the bedside in medical care. So that was an interesting topic and ongoing conversation.
Did they cite any interesting cases or anything like that at the presentation that you remember? Or
well, what
I'd be interested to know if there was...
You know, if a person, take for example, a person who falls through the ice, this is something that happens. Children fall through the ice on a pond. 20 minutes later, they find the body under the ice, get the body out, get the person to the hospital. Now it's 30 minutes since they've taken a breath and they're revived in the hospital. That's able to happen because conditions surrounded the brain in such a way that it didn't go without oxygen long enough to die.
Yeah. Drowning. And
right.
Yeah.
So the conditions in that particular instance is because it was so cold. The body was thrown into a kind of a very slowed metabolism such that the brain was still living. So that's an example of how, so for example, if you use the cardiopulmonary test alone, it might result in someone who's actually still able to be revived being declared dead. But you also have cases where someone who's being artificially kept alive by a machine, how do you determine when they if they've died. So, you know, cases where someone was living for years in a semi-vegetative or a vegetative state. Well, how can that happen? Well, it happens a lot because they're being medically kept alive, treated that way. So it gets complicated, but primarily what happens is a insufficient use, insufficient training of the tests that could determine brain death accurately and objectively. And so looking for ways to make that happen. We also had a very interesting conversation and presenter, Father Tad Prochalczyk. He is one of the stars of the NCBC.
Okay.
And their main ethicist. And he talked to us about efforts to extend human life. And one of the groups of people who are interested in trying to extend human life would be a group of people who are called transhumanists. And so
transhumanist.
What transhumanists want to do is to transcend human nature as it is and find some means to be immortal, to live immortally.
Through like AI,
right?
Some sort of microchip or something.
You see it on scientific, you know, science fiction movies, the brain in the jar, you know, that's hooked up with wires and able to talk through a computer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fundamental error in all of this kind of thinking is this kind of dualism between the body, which should be able to be just sloughed off or somehow transcended. That's the transhumanism, transcend the body to something that's better, either through robots or nanotechnology or AI or something, or through some kind of genetic manipulation. You know, we use, for example, genetics these days, all kinds of ways, to use, for example, stem cell transplants to treat cancer or something. There's a difference between using genetics to treat illnesses versus using genetics to try to create a hybrid creature. So to take a human person and somehow cross them genetically with something that's able to live longer or something, you know, somehow improve the human genome or something like that through this trans man kind of an idea. So it was kind of creepy. that conversation was kind of creepy. But the dualism that's mistaken there is one that we readily recognize. We want to live forever too. We believe that we can live forever with God in heaven. That's what having a relationship with our Creator.
Would we not say that we are made for eternity?
We are made for eternity as persons, as the persons God created us to be, not as machines, not as human-animal hybrids, not that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fun. That would have been a great conference to attend, I think. Something that's interesting is to note for those who listen to the podcast, just go to the National Catholic Center for Bioethics, check it out, NCBC, click around, see some articles. There's a ton of resources on there. Mm-hmm. And some of the speakers that Bishop has referenced, I think some of their content's probably on there as well. So very interesting stuff. And it is a rabbit hole. You can read about also, I mean, I generally tried to, and I was like, yeah, maybe I'll dabble in a few topics and Bishop and I could have a really educated conversation on transhumanism. And it's like, there's just so much information out there. So,
well, and the reason why they particularly put these workshops on for bishops is because bishops have a formal and particular relationship with the hospitals in their diocese, the Catholic hospitals in their diocese, to oversee and to cooperate and collaborate with the hospitals in trying to oversee and make sure that we're continuing to offer Catholic healthcare that is in line with what the Catholic Church believes is true and good about the human person, the dignity of the person. And technology constantly changes. So that's one area in which it's important to have something like this, paying attention to the new technology, the new medicines, are they for or against the true and the good of the human person? We know intuitively that the mere fact that we can do something scientifically doesn't mean that we should do it.
Right.
Sometimes we can do things scientifically that are immoral, unethical.
Yeah.
There may be types of medication that have effect, you know, for example, contraception. We believe that there's a right way and a wrong way to go about understanding and using fertility, and to use a medicine, a chemical, as a way to control fertility and to sort of leave God out of it is the wrong way. So that's an example. So that's one area. But the other area that increasingly is problematic is, for example, hospitals, particularly Catholic hospitals, are always treating the poor. I mean, that is bread and butter of Catholic healthcare, is to take care of those, even those who have no means to pay, which means that Catholic hospitals are often using and becoming dependent on Medicare and Medicaid, because those are national programs that help the poor be able to have medical care. But if the Health and Human Services Administration, for example, one of the many alphabet groups within the government, if they say that in order to be eligible for healthcare reimbursements, Catholic hospitals must observe, for example, Title IX restrictions. Title IX, which is a very good law that helps to make sure that women's sports and women's participation in college and so on and so forth is kept equal, suddenly becomes something different if the same alphabet organization,
yeah,
through a meeting that they had within their organization,
changes the definition
yeah, of sex.
Right.
So that sex is no longer male and female, but sex now must include all of the transgendered ideology and all of the aspects of same-sex attraction and so forth, so that now the hospital suddenly, without knowing that it happened, is not eligible for Medicare payment for anything unless they also offer transgendered medicine or transgender surgery and so forth. That's another area in which it's necessary to have a group like the NCBC paying attention to what's out there on the edges, so that we don't get caught in traps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. Fun podcast today. This was fun talking about bioethics. This was great. And just kind of as a public service announcement, before we close today, just to say, you know, if you have any ideas out there, and you want us to discuss them, please send them in to us, send them to our communications office, or send them to me directly to my email. You can find Daniel McKay and Renata Copsey as well on our website. So send us topics. So
yeah, because you asked last time about my favorite shows and so forth. Definitely just a category of my favorite shows is ones where we can talk about what people are asking.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. What are people interested in?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
A question that somebody has and we can bring it up
here. Absolutely. So we'll try to do that. So thank you all for joining us this week. This has been Tulsa Time with Bishop Konderla. My name is Derek Lissy. We hope you have a great rest of your week.